This is the Experience Points podcast for the week of March 20th, 2013, and we're turning this podcast into a board game. Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast, and my name is Scott Juster.
And I am George Elbor.
We're the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a serious but not humorless discussion about video games, and sometimes board games, and sometimes we get a little silly about it.
We do, yeah. Well, there's a lot of things that are silly about board games and video games.
Like Pop-O-Matic Trouble. That's a pretty silly board game.
Yeah, you know what? They never really quite figured out how to make the popping, you know, that sort of tactile feel in the digital space.
Oh man, that's such a sweet seg, but you're completely right. like the digital sound of dice rolling or some kind of like card shuffling or something, so hard to get correct.
I mean, it's so interesting because you can compare some games that do like the shuffling sound. Like I think Ascension is a digital version of a real world board game, or Magic the Gathering, right? Like when you see the decks and it's like a shh. I'm trying to recreate the sound with my voice, and that's even worse. But the point being is, like, there's this perfect space where if you can really capture some of the physical components of it, it makes a world's difference.
Yep. And that's kind of the topic of this podcast. You know, later on in the podcast, George and I are going to be talking with Sean Colombo, who, you know, that's what he does. He translates physical board games into digital, mainly XBLA, but, you know, also branching out into other platforms. And you know, we talk about that process. So, you know, stay tuned for that. But before, we just wanted to quickly chat. Every once in a while, we do talk about board games. So, you know, this is kind of like, what, our quarterly check-in about board games?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just a while ago, I was gushing over the Marvel Legendary board game.
Yep. And so, you know, yeah, so, like, where are we right now? Like, are we thinking about them in terms of, like, translating, you know, the experiences we have in digital video games to board games, maybe translating board games into video games? Like, what has been catching your eye recently?
Well, I mean, personally speaking, I think that these conversations are really interesting, and we talk a little bit about technology in the conversation with Sean, but with the onslaught of the PlayStation 4 coming around the corner and theoretically a new Xbox, it is interesting to think about how new technology could create a better relationship between board games and video games. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that caught my eye in the conversation we'll soon to have with Sean is you mentioned the sort of like iPad thing.
Yeah.
Why haven't we mastered that yet? Like,
Because it's gone rabid. That's why we haven't mastered it. I had to put it down.
I mean, Skylanders, right? Like, Skylanders is a good example. I mentioned that in the conversation as well. But, like, that is such a popular franchise for kids. But why don't we have cool tie-ins? Is it just not profitable? Is that the problem?
I mean, we discuss it a little bit. But, like, you know, to what you were saying, it is strange because technically it's all there. Like, we have Skylanders, we have video cameras that, you know, like, it's actually the perfect thing. Like, Kinect is not great enough to, like, get fine movement, but if you put a little figure in front of it, it'll probably be able to see it. Like, you know, we have that, we have voice chat with other people, like, we have all these components, and yet not quite, you know, the entire ecosystem, you know?
Okay, so two hypotheses.
Yeah.
The first one is that if you tie video games into board games, it is necessarily tacky and disgusting, right? I think that,
you mean like, just this is just like a extra media, transmedia push that's just kind of gross.
Yeah, it's just kind of a gross thing. This is just this is pure theory, right?
Right. Okay.
And one of the examples is I used to play this board game called, God, I think it was called Dragon Quest. Have you ever heard of this? It's like it was basically like D&D but with the board game. And it came with a VHS tape.
And you well, I mean, that is like a well-documented phenomenon. Like, there's that horror one where you're, like, going through a, you know, a mansion and stuff. Yeah, VHS-style video games. I mean,
Those VHS-style video games are so dumb because it creates this weird, it's a moment of dissonance between, okay, look at all the exciting action and cool stuff we're seeing on screen, and now we're moving these like characters that don't move, and they're all a monotone red color and plastic, and it's stupid, right? Like, there's two magic circles, right? The board game magic circle, where all of the little pieces that are normally dumb are awesome, and the video game magical circle, where like the graphics are great and are just fine. But when those two circles are next to each other, they create this weird dissonance. That's just one theory.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, let me tell you about Star Trek Zenit while you talk about this.
Okay.
Star Trek Zenit is essentially a VHS board game, but it's, you know, it's a DVD and everything.
You played Zenit before. Yeah, these are like the Harry Potter ones. They ask you like movie trivia and stuff.
Yeah, but there's also a board game where you're like, you know, going around the, like, that's where points are kept track of, basically. You know, sure. Your progress on the board is corresponds to if you answer things correctly on the DVD. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't know where I was going with that. Star Trek Zenit is kind of dumb, but it's still kind of dumb.
Well, that's a perfect example of the cheese factor, right?
Right.
I mean, it's okay to be cheesy because that's a party game, not like a legit, I'm going to sit down and spend like 4 hours game.
Yeah.
So my other idea, and this is not really much of a theory, this is me just thinking it would be awesome, but, you know, you see something like Risk Legacy, right? Mm-hmm. And for those who don't know, Risk Legacy is basically good old Risk, right? The old army dice rolling game.
A.K.A. bad old Risk.
Bad old Risk. And it's augmented to create this sort of huge metagame across many different matches of Risk. So, you know, eventually you get bonuses to your armies and where they're at, and you can seize control of territory, and you're telling this long story over 20 different Risk matches. It's
like persistent consequences over various games.
It's like if Risk suddenly had consequences, right? Yeah. Like, it's super cool.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem that far-fetched to me to create a sort of persistence and online aspect to these types of games in the digital space, right? Like, why can't we play Risk, right? And then when we're done with our match, we input the data into our computers, and then we play a weeks-long game of politicking, right? Mm. With real-world consequences that will affect the outset of the very next Risk tangible game that we play.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just, oh, why don't we have adaptations of one to another, but why don't we have experiences that sort of cross boundaries and then go back and forth between the two, when we have all of these really cool tools to allow that to happen?
I mean, some of it, again, you know, this is a theory too, but I remember, you know, there was this early rush in the days of this current, you know, waning console cycle, where like things like Settlers of Catan would like make it to XBLA, and then it seems like we're kind of somewhat in a lull there for a while, and now things are picking back up a bit. But now, if games were to be created on these next systems, like, social would be engineered into them from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And so you would have the idea that not just are you playing Risk or you're playing Settlers or whatever on your Xbox, but it is meant to be a persistent, always-on thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just meant to be downloaded as if, you know, it's the digital version of going to the store and buying a box and playing it. It is a persistent service, almost, that is going to be hooked into the rest of the console ecosystem.
Right, exactly.
Now we're in that mindset, you know, like, we're in that mindset now. So, like, even though everything is technically possible now, like, it's still somewhat kludgy. Like, it's been cobbled together as a reaction to what people want. And now, you know, over the next few years, we're going to be getting into the point where these things are, you know, like that from day one.
Yeah. Well, good.
I guess, yeah. I mean, it is, but, you know, then again, there's, like, the idea of, you know, people might not like, you know, people will just philosophically might be opposed to, you know, translating certain aspects of board games / video games, you know, from one sphere into the other.
Right, right. Well, either way, I mean, I think that if there's more opportunities to do it, even if it's not super common, we might see some really neat examples of crossing boundaries between those two genres, if you will.
Dark Souls, the board game.
Dark Souls, the board game. Why not?
Light because Souls. You would kill all of your friends.
I mean, how cool would it be, though, to play a board game and then, like, depending on the outcome of that board game, something happens in your game? I don't know.
Oh, no, he entered my game as a gray phantom.
I don't know. Okay, well, that's enough for our conversation. Why don't we hop over and chat with Sean?
Great.
Okay, I'm Sean Colombo, and I run Blue Line Game Studios with one other guy, Jeff Brown, and our main focus is bringing award-winning board games to Xbox 360.
So one of your recent board games, Hive, right? That's the one that you've launched most recently, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about what that game is, how do you play, all that good stuff?
Okay, so Hive is a game by British designer Johnny, and it's a hexagonal tile-based. So there's no board in the game to begin with, so it's kind of like dominoes, where you play pieces into the center. And it's two-player abstract strategy, which basically means it's like chess. So the object of the game is to surround the opponent's queen B tile, and the game's played with 11 tiles on each team, and each tile has a different insect on it, and they have different moves and abilities, very similar to chess in that way. And this game's been gaining a lot of popularity recently, which is, if you go into a Board Game Geek, which is kind of like the mecca for all.
It is. It's the weirdly organized mecca of board games.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. But there's intersection, and people are so obsessed with this game, they're taking it, because it's pretty portable too, so they'll take it to all these weird spots. So it's almost like a competition now to see like who can play the weirdest game of Hive. So there's like pictures of people playing out pyramids, and some people got scuba gear and they played on the bottom of the ocean. And so
that's kind of weird.
Like,
yeah,
like that XKCD comic where they're playing chess on the roller coaster.
Yeah.
So how long have you been playing, or had you been playing Hive?
Not long. When we decided to make board games for the Xbox, we played, there were a few games that we were looking at, and they were all Mensa award winners. We thought that'd be like a good theme, because if they can impress Mensa, then they have a lot of depth, so we figured we could sell them over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I was good at Hive, you know, I played like, you know, my little brother and my girlfriend, and that was about it. But then once you go online, you realize that the global community of people who play this game, they're just amazing at it. They're like chess masters. And I played a few games against the world champion, and he just destroyed me.
Oh, really? Wow. So what did that, out of curiosity, this is a bit of a tangent, but like, what did that game look like? Did you know you were screwed right off the bat? Or?
Oh, absolutely. It's like, is every move he made, I'm like, wow, I hadn't even thought you could do that. And like if I made a mistake, he'd make a move just to like show me, because you know, he's at such a higher level that to him it's more interesting just to like teach me why the move is bad. So
he's toying with you.
Yeah, very much so. And I learned you never want to make a ring of tiles in Hive, or you're in for a world of pain.
So. I guess I'll go into a little bit about why you got into designing board games for the digital space anyway.
Well, both Jeff and I had wanted to go into video games in general for a while, and I've been watching and reading about the game industry for about 4 or 5 years pretty heavily, and it seemed like independent games have a huge disadvantage in that it's really hard to get any eyeballs on your games. So I figured something that was an existing IP would be a great way to kind of bridge that gap. So, you know, you don't make as much profit per unit, but, you know, you can get some people to try your game just based on them knowing what they're getting into. A lot of people already know Hive and love Hive. So by using that, I can get people to care about the game. So, you know, when we posted our initial post saying that we were going to make the game, like we already had people saying, yeah, you can't wait for it to be out and stuff, which is like a great thing to have if you're an indie.
Right.
A sort of built-in community already.
Mm-hmm. And then, so that was just the justification for doing existing IP in general. But for board games specifically, it's just that we're both nerds and we're like playing board games. And Jeff had actually wanted to make the game Ket, which is a laser game, and it's the one we're building right now. He'd wanted to do that for a while too, and so it just kind of came together where we both thought it was like a great idea, and I'm like, yeah, I can lock myself in a room and write AI for months, so this sounds...
What was the thought process like behind targeting which platforms you wanted the game to come out on?
It was a couple things. So there's a lot of these games existing for mobile platforms already.
Mm-hmm.
So the licensing is already tied up. And we figured... There's a really good experience on a huge big screen TV for board games, and I think it's overlooked a lot. Like if you play Trivial Pursuit on Xbox, like it's great,
mm-hmm.
It's really good. And so we had some we've done an Xbox game before, just kind of, I did it on the side, and Jeff helped me a little bit with that too, called Coagulate. And so we had this code around, and we figured that we could make a really amazing looking, highly polished, very professional game on Xbox a lot more easily than we could on some other platforms. We dove into that, and you know, it's not going to be the only platform we're targeting for very long, but it was a great place to start.
One of the things that strikes me about, you know, just as I'm thinking about this, if I were in your shoes, the Xbox Live platform in general, is that they have a more unified social ecosystem around their platform. So if you aren't in the same room as the rest of your board game buddies, you know, it's, you know, you have the party system set up there.
Yeah, that was a huge advantage. Like, I remember the first time, like, I was working on the networking code, and I got it so that a game would run, and then I, like, laughed because I was so happy. I'm like, ah, that's awesome. And then I heard myself echo through my Xbox because it automatically sets up chat. So the microphone on my PC that I was using to debug was picking my laughter up and mocking me.
And then you continued to laugh, and it was instantly...
Yep. It was a self-perpetuating problem.
So when you first thought, okay, well, I want to work on translating Hive into an XBLA game, what were the conversations like when you first started approaching whoever happened to own the IP, as well as Johnny Yanni, you said, right, the lead designer?
Yeah, so he actually owns the IP, which is great.
Oh, wow, yeah, good.
Yeah, I noticed that the board game industry, like when I started digging games that I wanted to seek the licensing for, a lot of it is just very much like the indie video game market. Like, these people are all indies, and they have a few titles that are really popular, and that's kind of their bread and butter. So you're talking right to the game designer in most cases. So what I did is I just reached out to him and, you know, told him that I like the game and why I wanted to port it, and asked them if they'd be interested in talking. And interestingly, they all came back with almost the exact same questions. They wanted to know, like, if I'd worked with licensing before and if I'd made an Xbox game before. And just a little bit more about Jeff and I in general. So, you know, there's a little bit of, when you do it, it's a little intimidating and scary to, like, just cold email people. And you get like, a little bit of imposter syndrome, like, maybe, am I good enough to be doing this? But, and then when they came back with those questions, I'm like, hey, actually, I mean, yeah, I have made an Xbox game, and yeah, I have dealt with royalties with the music industry, which is probably one of the most confusing royalty issues ever. So we just sent them information about stuff we'd done in the past and kind of like a list of projects we'd built and some ways they could look at them, and it worked out pretty smoothly.
Did Yanni have any fears of going into the project about sort of translating it into the digital space? It feels like it's such a, especially for something that someone both owns the IP and they were the lead designer, sole designer on it, there's so much amount of trust that has to go into giving it to somebody else.
Yeah, he was remarkably brave. They did an iPhone version of it, which was kind of the guy's, you know, just side project. He loved the game, and he wasn't a professional game designer, but he made some iOS apps. So I mean, he'd been through that once before, and his main thing was, as long as he was involved in the process and got to like see and get feedback, and he was just so excited by the potential of it. So he started like bouncing ideas off us right away. Of like 3D insects on top of the tiles and all that good stuff. So having his expectations and the community's expectations kind of added, it changed the project a lot. Like when we announced it and there were people already commenting on it, that kind of, it took our original schedule from 3 months to, it ended up being 15 months to make the ended up making.
So. Out of curiosity, I imagine you were thinking about a bunch of different games you could have developed for the Xbox. Were there any games that you passed up on, and can you tell us why?
There's a couple that I ended up not doing yet. One is Pirate versus Pirate. I met the guy who designed that, and he has a good board game design history in his family. His parents made Apples to Apples, and he's actually in the Bay Area too. So,
oh, really? It's like the Downton Abbey of board game development.
Yeah, so, I mean, that game, I mean, it's still something we're considering in the future, but it's kind of like, after we got the licensing for both Hive and Ket, we got those, like, right at the same time. You know, our plate was pretty full for, you know, a year and a half or so. And then there's another game we're considering. It doesn't have much of a following in the board game world yet, though, so we're not sure that we can necessarily spend the time on it. But we'll see. Things are getting faster now. It's a lot faster to make Ket than it was to make Hive.
So on the general subject of bringing board games into the digital space, it feels like, at least from my perspective, over the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, board games in America, at least, have had a sort of huge resurgence. Mm-hmm. And I think that you're right in saying that we don't always see translations into the digital space, or we don't see very good ones. What do you think the main reason is behind that? Do you think that there's still a lot of room for growth for board games on digital platforms?
I definitely think there's a lot of room for growth. And I think there's a few things that are holding it back. So one of them is just that because I mentioned, like, these guys are pretty indie themselves, they have to find a video game developer who's willing to take, you know, an equal risk with them, because they don't necessarily have, like, a stash of cash to throw at someone to publish the game and be like, here, we'll give you 10 grand now, 10 grand at the next milestone, so start making our game. Like, they can't really do that.
So yeah.
They have to find someone who can, you know, survive for months without the income on the hope. Right.
Unless they're from the Apples to Apples family.
Yeah. Well, Apples to Apples has been acquired by, I don't remember if it was Mattel or Hasbro or who, but yeah, it's part of the big machine now. So the huge publishers that own a bunch of the games, they, you know, they're willing to go to EA and, you know, crank out a game. Mm-hmm. So the big games seem to be getting published, but and I guess another restriction that made it hard, which is one of the things that I noticed when I was looking at some of the games I wanted to convert, is it's really challenging to convert some of these concepts into something you can play on a console with other people. So any game with private knowledge, so like, you know how Scrabble, you have your little selection of tiles, and that stuff's pretty tricky. Ticket to Ride did an amazing job with it on iPad. Like, when you're done with your turn, you press a button, and then the screen's covered up and says, pass this to the next player, and then you have to click OK before the screen gets revealed again. Mm-hmm. So, like, that's, like, a really cool concept, but, like, there's not a really great way to do that when you're playing on a big screen TV with a bunch of your friends in the same room. So certain games just are kind of, no one's figured out a great way to do them yet.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like most of the time it's reliant on asynchronous play. And that doesn't really facilitate exciting matches, I guess. Because occasionally, right, Ticket to Ride, you could play with some friends on your phone, but it could be weeks before that game is over, where normally it might take you an hour, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it depends if you're playing, like, pass and play or online or what.
So now that you mentioned that, Sean, you know, George and I have discussed the whole, like, this last year's E3 was all about, like, the second screen phenomenon, and, like, the Wii U is about the second screen. And we're, you know, I would say somewhat bearish on the whole concept, if that is correct, George.
I think that's apt.
But it sounds like, I mean, you know, how do you feel, like, when you see the, you know, Microsoft second screen demo or something, does that strike you as something that is actually, you know, does that set off alarm bells in your head, you know, because you're looking at it from a board game perspective?
I mean, I think overall, all these people making the second screen devices and software are probably going to find that the players don't care so much, unless they do something really cool with them. But it would present a very cool opportunity for board game developers. I mean, if we had the time to dive into that, we could make, you know, I mean, Race for the Galaxy, Dominion, like, you could make a whole bunch of games a lot better if you had, like, a second screen to hide your personal data, and everyone could have their own second screen. But, you know, it is still a bit of a chicken and egg problem. Like, there aren't that many people who have these Wii U's and stuff to really create a huge market.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and even the audience for those particular games, right? I think you still find some people are very much against the idea of playing board games on an Xbox or a PC or their Vita or whatever, because so much of the board game experience is this sort of tactile experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I totally respect that point of view that, I mean, especially, so the game Hive, people just love putting those tiles down. I don't know why, but he got, like, the size of them perfect, and you put them down, it's, like, really satisfying, especially if you're, like, a little OCD. So.
It kind of reminds me of, like, Mahjong, the way you sort of stack them on top of each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, like, you know, dominoes itself, where you just slam down the domino.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's definitely a cool feature to that. And it took us a long time to get the sounds right and the polish right on the tiles in our game, just to kind of, like, still keep a little bit of that feeling. But it's almost like they're different uses. So, I mean, I don't expect too many people to gather on their Xbox to play Hive if they have the physical version in the same room. But, I mean, it has online networking, and most of my friends aren't, you know, within a couple miles of me. You know, people I met in college or worked with in various towns, like, they're across the world. So now I can play with all of them, and I can play with my extended family. And soon I'll be able to play against AI to get better.
I also feel like being able to immediately get the expansions in a digital space is pretty revolutionary for board games, right? Because even now, board game shops are pretty rare, right? I could maybe think of three in the greater Bay Area that I'm aware of. And it's not, you know, maybe they don't have them in stock, and maybe you have to order them online and get them sent in. Sometimes they're out of print. So being able to find and get digital board games is kind of a really neat experience if you're willing to have that non-tactile experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty cool instant gratification. I mean, I remember chasing down the core set of Killer Bunnies. It was so difficult. Like, everywhere had the expansions, and everyone was sold out of the game. And same with Cards Against Humanity. I had to wait months to get that. Like, I can't really think of anyone who would want the Xbox version and then not eventually buy the physical version.
Do you think that there's a possibility that, you know, now certain movies and even certain books, you buy the physical copy and get the digital copy? Do you think that there's any kind of future for board games with that?
Yeah. I mean, I would love to do that. I mean, the price point's so low on, like, the Xbox 360 versions are 240 Microsoft points, because that's what the market seems to be willing to pay for that kind of thing. And that's like $3. So, I mean, I'd be more than happy to, you know, bake that into a game. And one thing we're toying with the idea of is making it so you can buy an expansion. So Hive has a third expansion coming out. I think the goal is later this year, called the Pill Bug. And, I mean, I'd love to figure out some way to make it so you could buy the physical Pill Bug and have him appear in the game automatically, like embed a code in a package or something. So,
yeah.
Skylander style, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah, you put the tile in front of your webcam, and it'll be like, oh, you have the Pill Bug.
Yeah.
All that technology has been floating around for a little while, though. It's just no one has brought it together, you know? I mean, remember, you know, when Sony was trying to, like, get people to have their little iPads for, you know, the camera, and like all that stuff is there. It's just, you know, people just haven't tied it all into one package, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm willing to do something a little more ghetto and just give them a code with the Pill Bug and like, type the code in on the, hammer it in on the controller. But
yeah.
Not exactly the transmedia visual masterpiece one might imagine, but efficient.
Yeah. It gets people their bug, so...
Well, on the subject of technology, is there a piece of technology or something you could imagine that you think would make the relationships between board games and video games that much more interesting?
Well, there was some, I saw some dice, some digital dice that were coming out of Poland, which looked pretty cool.
You have to explain that for me. What is the concept? Is this some kind of crazy, like, random algorithm that they've cracked the code? Like, we've gone true randomness to this degree, you know?
Well, it's mainly that they have these dice that are about the size of normal dice, and the screens are all, I think the faces of it were LCDs or something. And then, so you could change the faces to be whatever the game needed, and then so you'd have physical dice in your hand. You'd roll these dice, they would be, you know, I mean, the sides would be showing as if normal dice. So you'd still get the experience of an actual dice throw. And then they would have, I think it was either RFID or Bluetooth or something, and they were communicating to an iPad or to a Microsoft Surface or something like that. So you had the physical sensation of the pieces still. And you know, by tying that with an iPad or a Microsoft Surface or whatever, you get the bookkeeping. Because that seems to be one of the favorite things people have about digital board games, is that the book is done for them.
True, yeah.
I still dream of the day when I could play D&D and sort of have the experiences reflected on the larger screen.
Yeah, that'd be pretty intense. Like holograms of it.
Yes. Space chess, really, is what I mean. So out of curiosity, are there any board games that, in a perfect world, you could get the license to any board game that you would absolutely want to work on to recreate in a digital space?
Well, I kind of like the concept. There's a whole bunch of, God, I'd like to shut them out and request them after I got denied. Take the licensing for, I'm trying to remember the name of this collection. It's amazing how well I repressed it. There's a bunch of, there's like 5 or 6 board games all by the same designer, in one collection. And, but I would have loved to do them. And they were all abstract strategy, which, I kind of love and is very easy for me to do now because the engine that we wrote for Hive is a pretty generalized board game engine. And, it has, an AI algorithm called Minimax built into it. So, like, making Ket, the idea was we would make Hive and probably not turn a profit on it, like a huge one anyway, and then we'd make Ket, and we'd do it in half the time, so we'd make some good money on it.
Mm-hmm.
But turns out we're actually able to make Ket in about a fourth of the time.
Nice.
Yeah. Hopefully we can keep that trend up.
Yeah.
Is there something that you think you would look for in particular when thinking about what games you would want to translate?
Yeah, so the earlier of sticking to Mensa Select games, I think that concept really seems to be panning out in the fact that they all, the more I've gotten to know the games, the more I've found in them, which is great. Like, the more, like, I read there's a strategy book, about Hive, and I read through the whole thing, and like, it was just filled with like, wow, okay, like it, that's like, there's like whole concepts that I hadn't even considered. And so that's really worked out. It has kind of been a double-edged sword in a way though. Like, by choosing Mensa Select games, I basically screwed myself to writing the hardest AI I could possibly imagine. so they're all, like, as soon as I start making the AI, I'm like, wow, this is, like, really slow. I should calculate the branching factor, which is, it's the number of moves that any given board position can get. And, I mean, it's a pretty reasonable number. I don't remember what Chess's number was, but, you know, it's pretty reasonable. But then, like, I'm realizing with Hive and Ket, like, I've really kind of dug myself a hole on that. Like, the size of the board in chess is 64 squares. But even though Hive doesn't have a board, you can, in theory, picture the size of the board you would need to contain any possible arrangement of the tiles, and that's 1,200 spaces.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So, yeah, I kind of dug my own grave with that one. But, you know, I mean, it's still worth it in the end, and I think I'm gonna keep up that strategy of that caliber of game, things that are very, very deep and have, you know, global tournaments and things like that.
Out of curiosity, have you had any players who are just super good play the game and comment on the AI?
Not the AI as it is yet. So we haven't released the AI. We didn't think it was good enough to go out, so we hid it and just didn't tell anyone it was there. noticed that in the credits, I still had some thank yous in there because a lot of the stuff for the AI came out of that strategy book that I got pre-release from the world champion was the guy who was writing it, and he gave me a lot of other tips. So we're about to put it into some more testing with those guys. The world champion's testing it, the guy who made the game's testing it, a couple of the other people who were, you know, top 5 in the world are going to be testing it too. So I'm pretty much going to get, I'm going to cry myself to sleep every night for a few weeks while they tell me it's horrible.
is your goal to make the Deep Blue of
yeah.
the Hive?
I mean, that would be fantastic, but I don't think there's going to be a Deep Blue running on an Xbox 360. I'm finding that's one of my hugest pain points is, like, I'm so happy with the level the AI is at now on a PC, but the Xbox 360 is 7-year-old hardware at this point. So, I mean, my phone in my pocket has more processor for computing power than my Xbox 360, so like I'll run it on there, and then it's like really slow and bad.
Yeah, that's really fascinating because it seems like when we talk about hardware, especially on the consoles from the more traditional video game side of things, we're always talking about the GPUs rather than the CPU mm-hmm. stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, it's interesting to hear someone talk about, no, it's just the raw computational power. It's not about textures or, you know, poly count or whatever. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because I know so little about creating AI. Like when you're making these pieces of software, like is the AI contemplating every move and just deciding what is most likely to be the best one, or how does it work if you were to try to describe it to a 3-year-old?
I mean, that's basically the way it works is contemplating every move. Fortunately, there's been a lot of research into AI for abstract strategy games, especially because of chess. And it's very reusable. So, I mean, the engine really does just look at every possible move that it could make and all possible moves the enemy could make if you make a move, your enemy's going to make the best possible move it can make. And then given that move, what moves could you make that would be your best possible moves, and on and on. And there's some very common tricks to make that so it doesn't have to look at quite every move, because there's ways you can prune the, that's called the decision tree. There's like mm-hmm. your game tree, depending on your point of view. And so as it goes through those moves, you can like skip huge chunks of it. But in the end, you're still looking at just absurd numbers of moves.
Wow. When you are adapting or creating difficulty levels, are you then just telling the computer to say, make the fifth best move instead of the first best move?
No, actually, I don't ever trick it to be stupid. I just trick it to not think for as long, basically. So there's like a few things you can tweak. So it's how deep in the tree you look, like one move ahead. Our easy is it looks at the moves, looks at what looks the best, and just does it. And then medium looks one move ahead to see like what the enemy would do next and how that position looks, and then hard. And
so like it thinks of like how you might respond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can tweak how deep it looks. The timeout, that's a big factor. So it starts looking through all these moves with the configuration you gave it, and then once it hits the timeout, it just says, well, of the ones I've got to look at, this is the best one. Yeah.
That's how they were able to beat Data on Star Trek The Next Generation. They were able to do kind of non-logical chess moves, and he couldn't handle it.
Yeah, that,
pro tip.
That yeah. Actually, I don't think that would work. But.
No!
So, I mean, you have particular insight then. Like, how far away are we from Skynet?
well, Skynet's not coming out of my AI system unless... Unless it can figure out a way to represent humanity as a bunch of board game positions. But
did Data ever answer what is love? Is that
he's figuring it out, man. He's figuring it out.
The learning process. Cool. Well, one of the last things we'd like to ask guests, Sean, is what have you been playing lately? What's been catching your attention, be it video game, board game, any of the above?
Actually, Escape Goat 2. I mean, I know that's kind of a bad answer because you can't get it yet, but I was just playing that 2 days ago, and it's, I mean, it's developed in the Bay Area, and it's so much better than Escape Goat 1. Oh my god.
What is Escape Goat for people who might not know?
So it's a PC and Xbox platform puzzler, and it's based on this. Well, it's based on puns, is basically, no. So there's a goat trying to escape, and he has a mouse with a magic hat, and, you know, you figure out puzzles, and it's very good, and it's done pretty well on Xbox and PC, but, it was very pixelized art in the first one, and now they pulled in the artist from, Randy O'Connell from Waking Mars, and it looks gorgeous in Escape Goat 2. And the lighting system is dynamic now, so I think it's going to do a lot better than the first one, because I think a lot of people see, you know, I think it was like 16-bit graphics or whatever, like the old, very old school style. Right. I just get like, kind of like, no, don't want to play with it.
Cool. All right. Anything else to add, Scott or Sean?
I don't think we're good. Yeah. This is fascinating. I'm thinking about what my console is thinking about while it's thinking about what I think about.
I know, but now I'm thinking about AI. Yeah. I can never think about AI. Yeah. I don't know. That's weird.
Yeah.
I think about it too much. I should leave in the debug buttons, because it can tell you what it's thinking. But
yeah. Oh, really? It's like, oh, I should do this move instead of that move.
Yeah, like how deep it's going. And I think one of the funniest parts would be when it times out to figure out like how good or like it can show you how far it got before it timed out. So you can see whether or not it really believes it made a good move or it's just guessing.
I wish people could program like nervousness or, you know. Because oddly enough, I was at a cafe this morning and I was watching two people play chess, and this woman was way behind this other guy. And over the course of like 20 minutes of them just staring at the board, she made a huge comeback. And I don't know, it's interesting how when pushed to a corner, sometimes the human mind gets a little bit more efficient. And that's, I mean, I don't know where you'd even begin to model that type of depth.
Yeah,
I think you could do it. I mean, I don't really have time to create personality AI, but a couple of people have asked for it. So, I mean, you could make an aggressive AI. So,
yeah.
But, I mean, it'd be pretty easy to make aggressive AI. So you just see, like, if you see a a position that's above this score, just assume it's awesome and just rush into it. And just be like,
yep. I mean, that's actually a really cool concept, because the idea of, no matter what board game you play, right, if you play a lot of board games, you're bound to encounter people with different play styles. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean you have to necessarily adapt your own, but the experience is different, right? So it's not just, oh, I'm playing someone who is better at me than this game, but they're playing in a different way and I'm forced to adapt.
Mm-hmm. If I had, like, infinite time to develop this thing, I think it'd be fantastic to make personalities. And those personalities would even be reusable across a lot of the different games.
Right.
You could have a cowardly personality.
Yeah.
And even the idea of, like, playing... Because you could play a personality that tries to trap you in certain ways, right? Like, if you want to get better at Hive, and you've mastered one aspect of it, you could have a personality that is good at the type of play that you're bad against as a sort of form of practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
We'll get on it, Sean.
Alrighty. I know what I'm doing tonight.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for chatting with us. That was awesome.
Cool. Thank you, guys. Thanks for having
me. Yeah, really appreciate it, Sean.
Thanks again to Sean Colombo for coming on the podcast this episode. I am now scared of all of my computers.
I think that's probably for the best.
If anyone wants to write in to reach us, experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And experiencepoints.net is the website. Come on down, bring your friends, play some board games.
All right, until next time, everyone, thanks so much for listening, and take it easy.
Bye-bye. Okay.